appreciate your help.
Excuse me. Excuse me. Excuse me. There will be plenty of time for questions later. I'm Captain John Harriman, and I'd like to welcome you all aboard.
It's our pleasure.
I just want you to know how excited we all are to have a group of living legends with us on our maiden voyage. I remember reading about your missions when I was in grade school.
Oh, really?
Well, may we have a look around?
Please, please.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton reporting for duty.
And now for this week's conundrum, Star Trek's biggest losers.
Whoa, Cam, that is controversial. I'll have you know, Star Trek is nothing but winners, but let's get on with it. Let's be honest. There are some characters that... I don't know if you want to call them lamewads or jerks or dorks or what have you, but there's just something that stands out about them. It's like, this is not in a very effective character, and I'm not always convinced it's because they were meant to be that way in the script. It's just a combination of things, whether it's like the actor chosen to perform, the dialogue given, the direction given, it just isn't working. But there are a few examples that we'll go through here. Where I think it is obvious, like, this person was meant to be a quote-unquote loser, or at least for story purposes. Well, do you have any different ideas about what we mean by one of Star Trek's biggest losers?
Well, I think I'm going to go through them as I kind of name some of my picks, because I tackled them from different angles.
Okay.
Some are just flat out, like, you know, fail horns.
Sure.
You know, like, they're just like a gong show from beginning to end. Others, it's more about their story function, and, you know... Like, what the role they play within the show and how the writing is essentially working against them.
Yes.
So we're going to kind of go across, and I think you're going to get a tapestry of losers.
Loserdom?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? You take it away, sir.
Okay. Well, let's start with, maybe the most obvious one, just to get out of the way, and that's Captain Harriman.
Okay.
From Star Trek Generations, yeah. Played by Alan Ruck. He is the new captain of the Enterprise when Kirk, Chekov, and Scotty... the most random trio of the original series ever assembled, are put on the on board. They run into some issues with the Nexus space ribbon, or whatever you want to call it. And Kirk is blasted into space.
Yes, because Captain Harriman's sense of leadership, it's not coming until Tuesday, along with everything else aboard that ship.
Yeah, so I mean, Scott Hardy in our Klingon Bloodwine games gave a very passionate defense of Captain Harriman. I don't know that I should...
I don't know if it was a sincere defense.
It was though. 100% sincere.
Okay.
He's a huge Captain Harriman fan. But, you know, this character, you know, when you look at the way he's written, he is standing next to James T. Kirk, we know is like the greatest captain of the Starship Enterprise, up until, you know, Picard's going to take over. And this is the sad sack stuck between... Kirk and Picard? Like, really?
And you know what? Like, honestly, as opposed to what I was saying earlier, I think this is a good example of he's supposed to be the sad sack.
Yes.
But do you think there were just... Couldn't you find a... From the perspective of the writers, could you not have created a character who seemed at least had to possess some baseline competency, but could have still showed how he was missing certain elements that Kirk had? Like, maybe that just sense of cowboy pizzazz, as opposed to, you know, like something like that. Instead, they just had to make him like the biggest bumbling, like feckless sort of replacement. Like it's almost as if like Starfleet's embarrassed by the name Enterprise at this point.
And it goes straight into the casting. Like, you don't cast Alan Ruck, who's famous for playing, you know, the anxiety-ridden Cameron in Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Yeah, anybody named Cameron. Obviously a loser.
Obviously.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't make sense, just from a casting perspective, to stick this guy in there and expect the audience to look at him as anything other than just a clueless dimwit.
Yeah.
I just don't understand because... because I just don't understand how, you know, why the Enterprise is such a major ship, and we've seen in the past, you know, the glimpse we got in the animated series of Robert April. It's not like he was a buffoon. Kirk's obviously not a buffoon. Picard is, you know, awesome. Like, why is it they decide in Generations, well, here, this other Captain of the Enterprise is a complete doof.
I don't know, Cam, but let me ask you this. Have your opinions on Alan Ruck changed ever since we saw him at Fan Expo Vancouver?
No.
Does Captain Harriman appear to be less of a loser now after you and I saw him in person a few years back?
Well, it was easy to see him because there was no people around him at his table.
There was a baby that he was playing with.
It was awful. It was one of the most uncomfortable things ever.
It was uncomfortable to see. I like Alan Ruck.
Me too.
I thought he was great.
He's good in Speed.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. Just as one of those passengers. Yeah. Even I remember watching him on Spin City with Michael J. Fox.
And yeah.
He played like a real prick, but I thought he was like good.
Yeah, like I have no issues with the way that Alan Ruck plays Harriman. I mean, this character is written to be just hopeless.
Yes. It all comes down to the writers. Do you think the writers were effective at creating a loser character? Is this an effective loser?
Yeah, I guess. Okay. But I'm more baffled, not that he's a loser, but that they would make the captain of the Enterprise, the flagship ship, such a loser. Like, it doesn't even make sense to me.
Like, from not from the writer's perspective, but from, like, Starfleet's perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree. So, you know, why don't we jump over to somebody, you know, somebody who I think was written specifically to be a loser. And I think he's actually one of the more intriguing characters from Star Trek, because we don't see much of this in how civilians are depicted in Star Trek. I'm talking, of course, about Richard Bashir. This is Dr. Julian Bashir's father, who's never able to hold down a job. He even is so concerned about, like, his young son's intelligence that he breaks the law and gets Julian Bashir genetic engineering, you know? So maybe he doesn't have that much confidence in his own skills as a parent, you know? So there are concerns that obviously he loves his son, but this guy is depicted as a loser. Would you consider that, Cam?
Yeah, very much so. Because in Star Trek, every human being, it seems, knows what their, like, what their career path is.
Yes.
You never see people really wavering with trying to decide, unless you get, like, say, Wesley, you know, deciding to drop out of Starfleet Academy or something. But for the most part, people tend to know what they want to do and stick to it. Like, look at nowadays where people have, they say the average person can have, like, what, like, 3 careers or something like that, or 4 careers over their work span. That is not the case in the 23rd and 24th century. It's like, once you're in, you're in.
Yeah, well, look at Jake Sisko. He knew he wanted to be a writer since he was a teen.
Yeah.
Look at Nog. He did not want to be, like, his own father.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, look, but speaking of his own father, speaking of career shifting, he goes from, bartender to Bajoran Fix-It Man to Grand Negus. So there's a guy who, he may switch careers a lot, but he certainly has an upward trajectory in that respect there.
Unlike but Richard Bashir.
Who, like, I think the latest job that he had, he was holding down, was as a landscape architect.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't a Mick job, you know? This is a guy who just seems to change all out careers just every few months or years, and obviously, like, Julian is embarrassed by his father, but do you think it goes beyond that? Do you think he also just resents his father?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's serious resentment. I mean, you can understand why. If Bashir is an advanced human being, essentially, you know, genetically altered to be superior, he is completely outside of his father's realm of achievement. Like, there's nothing that his father could do that he can't do better. And so to have this father who's not even, like, you know, if his father, say, was, like, just a really good Starfleet officer, nothing spectacular, just, you know, a good officer, even that he might have more respect for, but it's the fact that his dad is just kind of bumbling at everything, that Bashir has excelled at probably everything he's done all his life. I mean, it's always, they say, the greatest thing, dignity, when your kids become, you know, say, like, faster than you or stronger than you or whatever. He was probably better at his dad than most things at, like, the age of 15.
That's true. But, okay, he obviously has this resentment aimed towards his father, who is depicted as a rather charismatic fellow.
Yes.
But
Brian George is really, like, lovable in the role.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but do you think he has the same feelings towards his own mother, though?
I don't know.
And she's not depicted as, like, this such a loser. No. Although she's the one who's married to this guy and has stuck around with him and was complicit in decisions like to get her son genetically engineered.
Yeah, no, it's quite true. I mean, the show seems to have really no attitude whatsoever towards the mother character. It's really focused on Richard Bashir.
Yeah.
And I don't really know why.
Hey, if you got Brian George, you've got gold right there.
I mean, he's great in the role.
But, you know, one of the things I do recall reading in the Star Trek Deep Space Nine companion book is that they had a tough time casting Julian Bashir's mother.
Right.
Because I think at the time in Hollywood, there weren't a ton of women of Middle Eastern descent working as actresses in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if they necessarily were confident about their ability to get a real strong actress into that role. I don't know if maybe they just weren't looking hard enough at that point in time. Deep Space Nine, of course, has a limited budget, even like relative to nowadays. So I think nowadays, if Bashir's mom, you know, were to make an appearance for the first time, you'd definitely give her a lot more to do because there's so many more actresses nowadays that would be able to take on that role.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, I agree.
Okay, Cam, who's next up on your list?
Okay, well, let's talk about a little character I like to call Tapestry Picard.
Oh, you know what? Okay, it's so funny because, Cam, did you see me, like, jot a little note down just a second
ago?
No,
I didn't.
Okay, I actually wrote down Junior Lieutenant Picard on my notes.
Yes.
Because he just sprung to mind. That is an amazing pick. Tell reader or listeners why this guy is such a loser, Cam.
Okay, well, this is the famous episode Tapestry from Next Generation where it's sort of like a Christmas Carol type story where Q shows Picard what his life could have been in, you know, a different future or so forth, a different reality. And, we see that had he not been stabbed by the Nausicaan, he would become an assistant astrometrics officer and just be a total sad sack that, like, the rest of, like, the superior Enterprise crew just, like, looks over.
Barclay looks down upon, you know, the blue-shirted Picard.
What's great about sad sack Tapestry Picard is that it really plays off of Patrick Stewart's physicality. Patrick Stewart is not a big man.
No.
And now as Picard, you know, he stands up and he's definitely got like the dignity and sort of that majesty with it, you know, the Shakespearean delivery of his dialogue. But in this performance, you get to see how he uses that same physicality, the sort of smaller man, to kind of like shrink down and just look insignificant.
I even wonder, though, if the costume department maybe gave him just like a size just a little bit too big, just
right,
like, as if he's wearing his dad's outfit to work that day.
Yeah.
You know, I think he's one of our inside jokes, you know, among our friends. Cam, a few years ago at one of the big Las Vegas conventions, I encountered a custom-made Loser Picard action figure.
Yes.
Which I paid $12 for, and it still happily sits on my shelf with Picard in his blue uniform. I'm very proud of that.
Did it come with any accessories?
No, it's just one of those, like, I think, like, what would happen is these comic book shops would receive or mail out these custom figures.
I think it was done through Toy Fair magazine.
Oh, okay.
It was like a mail-away figure.
Yeah, that makes more sense.
They did a whole line of those. There was like a Yesterday's Enterprise, Tasha Yar, a couple others.
Yeah, so there's a couple ones that you would not... They're essentially based on the Playmates figures.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not ones that you would ever buy in like a Playmates Star Trek Next Generation package. This came in its own little box. But it's... Cam, I was like, you saw me. I was beaming when I encountered this, and if only the guy, the vendor, knew how much I wanted this, he could have actually risen the price, and I would have paid. So
it's a great episode. Like Tapestry is a really fantastic Q episode. Like if we ever rank our Q episodes, like that to me goes way up the line. But I just love that it finds an opportunity just in this little moment to have this really iconic and very funny moment of just the Picard that could have been. And I just love that it's not even like Picard kind of being modestly successful. It's just Picard just looking so sad.
Do you think it's possible in like the Prime Universe is actually an alternate Q timeline and the real Prime timeline is one which, you know, one Captain Barclay is the greatest, you know, captain in the entire Starfleet.
Get out of my fan fiction.
Okay, well, there you go. Well, Cam, next up on my list, though, is a certain character that I don't know if most people would be aware of this. And he was actually, I think, part of the inspiration for this episode. Okay. You and I were recently watching one of your favorite episodes of Star Trek Enterprise, Bound.
Yeah.
Heavily featuring Tripp's replacement, Commander Kelby.
Yes.
This guy, of course, he's under the influence of pheromones, but a lot of his resentments against Tripp, who's, seconded from the Columbia at this point, they come to the surface, and Kelby just, like, he's in bed with one of these Orions. He's just like, he doesn't believe in me. He doesn't think I can do all the things that I can do. I'll show him. And he literally starts trying to take over the ship and sabotage it to give it to the Orion slave girls.
Yeah, Kelby's actually a perfect example of a different type of loser that I want to talk about in this episode. It's the character who's presented as an alternative to your hero.
Yeah.
And so it has to be proven wrong over and over and over again. And Kelby's in, like, I think 6 episodes, probably one in the Mirror Universe where he's killed by the Gorn, proving that he's the ultimate loser.
Yeah. If somebody cannot outrun a Gorn, then, yeah, you are a loser.
But so he's probably in 5 episodes as, you know, the prime Kelby. But, I mean, this character, you know, he takes over from Tripp. You know, even initially when he's brought into the job, he's, like, overwhelmed on the job. And then, you know, and then Tripp comes back. And it's just, like, Kelby is there to be proven again and again that Tripp is the greatest engineer.
Do you think it's a thankless role for any actor to take on at this point? Because I think for some of the people that we're going to go through, maybe, you know, a different actor could have brought a different element here. But I don't know if any actor could have really salvaged this particular character.
No, I don't think so. It's a character that is just not, like, he's not a valuable character.
He's a loser by design.
He's there to be easily replaceable.
But what about this particular actor, though? Like, do you think he was meant to come off as whiny as he did?
Well, he was played by Derek Magyar, and no offense to Derek Magyar, but I feel like he's, just the way he's kind of made up to look in the show, he kind of has that sort of, like, frat kind of guy look. In a way, like, Tripp looks a little kind of softer, kind of southern gentleman, whereas there's sort of that harder kind of almost, like, entitled... He looks like he could play, like, the rich jerk in a high school comedy or, you know, college movie.
I don't recall Kelby's first name, but it wouldn't surprise me if it was something like Drake or Chadwick.
That'd be amazing, Chadwick.
I like that. Chadwick Kelby.
Yeah, he just has that look to him that you want to see him get his comeuppance.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talked about Captain Harriman. You know, you don't cast Alan Ruck to follow Kirk. Like, it's just, he doesn't look like the alpha male next to Kirk. Just like, I feel like this guy does not look, he doesn't look friendly and down to earth. He looks kind of full of himself. And I haven't seen much of this actor's other work. He may be far more versatile than I'm giving credit for in this particular episode, but the episode doesn't, or these 6 episodes don't do him any favors in being able to kind of show the palette.
What do you think happened to Kelby after Tripp came back and took over as chief engineer once again of Enterprise? Do you think Kelby went and they essentially flipped jobs and Kelby became chief engineer of Columbia? Or do you think that the captain of the Columbia was just like, no, we've looked at his personnel file. I'd rather just promote from within.
I feel like he probably just stayed on Enterprise in a smaller role.
Oh, he would take the demotion, you think?
Yeah.
I don't know about that.
You don't think so?
You know what? Starfleet's starting to grow at this point, and I think he could have easily found more opportunities.
Good point.
He does not want... Do you think he really wants to stick around on Enterprise underneath Tripp's thumb at that point?
They made Enterprise Season 5. Would we have seen Kelby still under Tripp? Still angry?
No, we would have seen Captain Kelby, a big plot line going on with him as part of the new NXO fleet that was, you know, taking over.
Right, right.
That would have been amazing.
It was funny. One of the details on Memory Alpha about Kelby, they had, like, the trivia about the character. And they were talking about the episode Bound, and they said there was a line that indicated that he actually had, you know, sealed the deal with the Orion girl.
Okay.
And they said they cut that out.
Well, so he didn't even get that.
Even the most minor of triumphs for Kelby are stripped from him.
Well, wait a minute. I do recall him in the bedroom with
It's implied for sure. For sure. But they took out a line indicating that this was the case. I just
you know what? He needs a hand up. I'll give it to him. I'm going to assume that he didn't seal the deal.
Why not?
Okay.
But he is like we watched that episode Bound. We had a weekend away with Seattle, a bunch of our friends from the Las Vegas Star Trek convention. And we just had like episodes on as background. And Bound just is like a perfect background episode because it's so goofy and ridiculous. But we kept cracking up at everything Kelby had to do because he is the perfect Star Trek loser.
Oh, absolutely.
And he's one that you don't mind watching lose.
No. So, Cam, who's next on your list here?
Okay, well, I want to talk about a guy from the original series. He has an episode named after him. That is Charlie X.
I don't know why he would be considered a loser.
This would be one Charlie Evans, who was played by Robert Walker Jr., and he's the young man who was sort of raised by aliens, is taken in by Kirk, and Kirk kind of has to tutor Charlie in how to be a human male. And Charlie is a hugely problematic character.
Well, he's got huge powers, for sure.
Sure, sure.
But he doesn't really know how to be a man yet, does he, Cam?
No. So there's a really awkward scene of Kirk in very tight spandex teaching Charlie how to do roles. But a lot of this episode is about him not only just, like, being hopelessly overshadowed by the pure masculinity of Kirk, but also just depicted scene and scene again in the most awkward of encounters with Janice Rand.
Well, just there was inappropriate touching involved that he did not quite realize that he could not get away with that.
Yeah, and every time he gets upset, he gets this really bizarre look on his face.
Cam, I cannot do it justice, but it looks like somebody is incredibly constipated at that point.
Yeah.
You know, I maybe he could have used some better directing.
Yeah, and apparently in the original script there was an extra scene where he forces a young ensign to her knees for not looking like Janice Rand.
I'm glad they cut that one.
Yeah, it's just like, maybe it's in the Roddenberry vault. Okay. We'll be getting that just in time for Christmas.
Oh, dear Lord.
But now this episode, which I think is at least a fun episode, it's pretty goofy.
Yeah.
Is there anything redeeming about this character? Because I think we're supposed to sympathize with Charlie. Did you ever?
No, I found him very annoying. And just the other thing I found annoying was just the writing and like how I realized the 60s were a different time. But guys, come on. Like, just the way that the whole conceit that Kirk has to teach him how to be a real man and how to really get women. And it was weird stuff going on here.
Yeah, it's very strange, and you can't help but, like, when they take Charlie away at the end, and they're like, well, okay. But it's just like, you know what, maybe Charlie's better off there, because did you get the sense that this guy would ever be able to live in human society? No. He was very strange.
Yeah, and the other, like, what did you think about, like, the homoeroticism going on throughout this episode? Do you think that it was intentional on the part of the creators back in the day, or was it just, maybe I'm looking too deeply into what I thought was some very obvious homoeroticism going on between Charlie and Kirk?
I don't think it was intentional.
Yeah.
I don't think.
But essentially, you've got, like, Kirk in a kimono, like, teaching Charlie X.
Kimono? No, far less. Tight spandex pants and no shirt.
Oh, wait, Charlie was wearing the kimono,
yeah, he's
right?
Wearing the kimono, and yeah, like, Kirk's all oiled up.
He's oiled up and teaching Charlie all these moves, and it's like, okay. Yeah, this is episode. This is what, like, the second episode to air?
Yeah.
You know, interesting that this is how they wanted to introduce Star Trek to the world.
It's an amusing episode.
Yeah.
But Charlie definitely falls into the, you know, Star Trek Loser Hall of Fame.
Okay. Speaking of which, I definitely have an entry here.
Okay.
One, Alexander Rozenko.
Yeah, he's on my list too.
I mean, like, I feel bad for it because I think you start off with, like, some not great child actors playing Alexander, and you can't help but make fun of this character.
Right.
But then we also see Alexander throughout different ages. Remember that episode of Star Trek Next Generation where Alexander comes back in time as an old man, and he's supposed to help Worf out? And you realize, like, Alexander turned into a big loser because Worf was carrying some sort of disgrace or what have you.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, maybe there's, like, this timeline change that could happen, that Worf could get his act together, realize he doesn't need his son to become a loser. Worf could become a much better father figure. It seems to be, like, a constant issue here that Worf realizes by the end of the episode he needs to be a better father, and Alexander keeps falling in the same patterns.
But does Worf really ever step it up?
No, I think Worf, like we've mentioned this a few weeks ago, I think Worf is a legit bad father. I mean, he's a great character. That doesn't mean he's a good father at all. But when we're reintroduced to Alexander years later in Deep Space Nine, he is truly written as a loser. Like, that is his role on the ship, where, like, literally, like, he doesn't know, you know, credits from Navy Beans at this point. That's my shout-out to one assistant engineer, DeSalle, from Cat's Paw.
Right.
Anyway, but he doesn't know anything about how a ship works. He's essentially there to... he's on the Rotaran with Klingon Imperial forces, essentially to prove to his father he could be a soldier?
Yeah, but all he does is screw up.
He doesn't seem to want to be around his father either, but why else would he join this, like...
Alexander crew? Is just a bizarre character to me, because Star Trek traditionally doesn't really embrace characters. I feel like a lot of the characters who fall under the quote-unquote loser category are more by, like, fall into that by plot circumstances or whatever. Alexander is a character who is in countless episodes of the series, carried through, you know, through TNG and DS9, and they never once figure out how to use that character in any way that isn't, like, goofy or, frankly, pathetic.
Does it surprise you that eventually the writers gave up and they said, no, you know what, Deep Space Nine, we're just going to write him as a loser because that's what the joke is among the fans?
Do you think that was an in-joke episode, like, to them?
Well, not necessarily an in-joke, but they just realized, like, everybody just... thinks of this guy as a loser, and I think it's acknowledging on their part that on Next Generation, Worf was not a good father. They're like, what happens to a Klingon warrior when his father sucks? Like, his father's not there for him. It really isn't doing much to be a good father figure.
Do you feel like Worf was ever in any way punished for this, though? I feel like Worf got off pretty light in terms of the way the series depicted him.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely. And that's why I don't think it's as commonly talked about among the fans, you know, that Worf is a bad father.
Yeah.
You know, he's very much absent throughout much of Alexander's childhood until he gets to Deep Space Nine. We see Worf in Way of a Warrior. He's carrying a photo of Alexander. That's the last we see of Alexander up until season 6.
Yeah.
Which is very strange.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't have been hard to just get an Alexander actor in there.
We've already had 14 at this point.
Exactly.
Why not another?
Yeah. Now, would you say that Alexander was always a loser? Cause I don't think so.
No.
He was kind of a overly precocious kid. I think he's annoying as maybe a character, but I don't think he reaches, like, loserdom until maybe Deep Space Nine?
I think that's when he is overtly a loser.
Yeah.
I think he was just, like you said, kind of an annoying kid.
Yeah.
But, well, there's that Next Gen episode that I mentioned where the old adult version of Alexander's kind of a loser. But one of the issues, though, is, I mean, this kid is somebody who essentially witnessed his mother's murder.
Yeah.
His half-human mother. So, I mean, he's got the human genetics working against him when it comes to being a real Klingon warrior. He has an absentee father who's not really teaching him all that much.
Mm-hmm.
He really has the odds stacked against him when it comes to being a successful Klingon warrior, does he not?
He does, and, you know, we see on the show, like, he can't, you know, use a batleth well, and it's to this, you know, great shame of Worf. But it isn't portrayed as, like, Worf having to learn that his son has different talents. It's more portrayed as, boy, that must suck for Worf.
Yeah, because here's the thing, like, Jake Sisko was never interested in pursuing a career in Starfleet. It wasn't like Ben was just going to give up on him. He appreciated the fact that Jake had other skills, and that was embraced by the show.
Yeah. Do you think that's just the difference in the eras of when TNG is being written versus, like, the later Deep Space Nine?
Yes. I absolutely do.
Yeah.
And I think there's a certain amount of self-awareness when it comes to storytelling, and I think a lot of that's due to the fact that Deep Space Nine was on a station that was static, which meant a lot more focus on the characters, but I think there's more self-awareness on Deep Space Nine of kind of some of the storytelling tropes that they would fall into on other series that they wanted to acknowledge and maybe better themselves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I just wish that, you know, the Alexander story didn't feel so just wrong. You know, you watch, like, we talked about Fistful of Data a couple weeks ago, And yeah, it ends with this like playful, like father and son are going to be, you know, bonding more. And this, it's just like, I feel like Alexander's life is just doomed to like kind of be always pathetic.
Yeah.
I never get the sense, even though, yes, he's accepted by the, you know, the crew aboard the Ratarn, that, you know, Alexander's life is going to be good from now on.
No, because the whole reason he's accepted by the crew is they see him as a good luck charm because he's so clumsy.
Yeah.
And it's just like, okay, like, what is this guy, what is the end goal with that character?
Right.
He's going to live in his father's shadow. Beyond that, I don't know. I think Alexander is a loser.
Yeah.
Hall of Famer, for sure.
Yeah, Hall of... Well, let's get to another Star Trek offspring and talk about David Marcus.
Okay, I look, how could this not be on anyone's list?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
With David Marcus, I don't think it was the writer's intention of making him a loser. Nicholas Meyer, of course.
No, I don't think so.
He
is whiny, though.
Yeah, it comes down to, obviously... the guy's got, like, daddy issues, this resentment. He never grew up with father, but he has heard all these stories about this wild man known as James Kirk, a bit of a swashbuckler. So he obviously resents him, and what we do get is, like you said, Cam, like a whiny guy who doesn't want Starfleet touching his science, what have ya. But a guy who
sweater always, tied around his neck.
Also prone to wearing sweaters around
his
neck.
He looks like he should be teaching tennis.
Do you think he could have been named Chadwick Marcus as well?
Yeah, he's very much cast in the era. Like, oh, yeah. I feel like Star Trek generally did a good job in casting types who look like they could fit kind of any time period. You know, you look like, say, like Mark Leonard. Mark Leonard looks like Mark Leonard. You know, he doesn't look like there's a groovy Mark Leonard from the 60s. You know what I mean? David Marcus looks like he's from the 80s.
Do you think he would have fit right in a 1980s ski film, you know, where, like, sure. They're on the slopes.
That, yeah, why not? Hot Dog the movie?
Yeah, they're ski bunnies that they have to take care of, or, sure. You know, that sort of stuff. He looks very 80s.
He also looks like he'd be on Blue Lagoon.
Yeah, then I never even thought about that.
Yeah.
Of course, in the Brooke Shields role, right?
Obviously.
Yeah, okay.
Or pouring pig's blood on Sissy Spacek.
Okay. Do you think David Marcus... played by a different actor, he was, of course, performed by Merrick Buttrick. Do you think a different actor could have brought something more redeemable to this character, who I thought was just kind of, like, a little insufferable?
Well, here's the great question about Marcus, though. What did they want him to be? Because I'm not sure I've ever been able to figure it out.
No, well, I think by Star Trek 3, you want to be... feeling like this punch in the gut when he's killed, and that gives, of course, Kirk a lot of motivation.
Right.
I think that moment in which Shatner falls into his chair after realizing that David's been killed, I think that's one of Shatner's best moments ever captured on screen.
Yeah. The death scene, though, is pretty goofy. Like, yes, yeah. They give him a bit of a heroic moment, saving Savick. But then he, like, dies in the most pitiful fight ever.
It really
is. It's like, oh my god.
I just think, it could have been an even more effective death if, I don't know, the actor brought something, just a little bit more charm or charisma to the role.
You can't cast someone to play James T. Kirk's son and have them be, like, a wet dish rag.
No.
It just doesn't make sense. And so I've always been kind of baffled by this character because... I don't have a clear sense as to ever what they wanted. Did they want him to be kind of like a kind of, you know, like a beta male sort of scientist? Is that what they want? Or is that just what it comes across as? Like, I've never had a clear idea as to what this character is.
I wonder if the intention, though, was to have... Because Nick Meyer always really viewed Starfleet as a military organization.
Yeah.
And I wonder if David Marcus was supposed to be the... science version of a swashbuckler to a degree. Like, he's got...
Swashbuckler, huh?
Well, he's got, like, Kirk's genetics, and maybe that's why he seems so irreverent to the whole idea of Starfleet. He's like, screw them, we can do whatever we want, we're scientists. And maybe that was the idea. I just don't think Merrick Buttrick really brought that, though. I think there's had to be something very important going on with that character. He's supposed to be the son of Kirk.
He should have a little bit of devil may care attitude.
Yeah.
I'm not saying make him like Kirk clone, but just you got to give him a personality, because I got to be honest, I think one of the great failings of Star Trek 2 and 3 is that I don't feel any attachment to David Marcus, so when he dies, I honestly don't care.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like about as emotionally moved by the death of David Marcus as I did about Sam Kirk in Operation Annihilate.
I mostly just felt bad for Jim. I was just like, oh, that sucks for you, man.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel bad that David was gone, and I just was not invested in that character.
No, I felt the same way. There's so many balls to juggle in Star Trek II. I just wonder if there should have been maybe they should have figured out another way to deal with that storyline, like maybe bring in David Marcus in a different movie or something.
Can't wait for the rebooted version of David Marcus. You and I, we discussed this before. We did not get the impression that in Into Darkness that Carol Marcus and Captain Kirk ever copulated.
Right.
So I don't think David Marcus is going to become an entity in this rebooted universe.
He was barely an entity before.
Yeah, so there you go. They solved our problem, people. Don't need a recast Merrick Buttrick.
You know, the character's a loser when they won't even bring him to the other timeline.
No. Well, you know, if we're on this thread about, like, sons, I've got another one for you, Cam.
Mm-hmm.
And I bet you won't even recognize his name, but I'll throw his name out there and see if you can name it. Because it's actually, he's the son of a rather prominent character. Do you know who Drex is?
It's not ringing a bell.
Because he is only brought up once, and after that they're like, this guy's a loser. We're not going to bring it. It's actually Martok's son.
Oh, okay, yeah.
First featured in Way of the Warrior. Essentially, he just goes around harassing people on the promenade. Beats up Garak. Yeah. Garak's like, I don't want any trouble. And then essentially, a season later, Martok becomes far more prominent in the series, and essentially, Worf becomes his adopted son. And I think it's very telling that if Worf, who's been, you know, dishonored across the Klingon Empire, loses his entire house, and Martok would rather have you as his son,
yeah,
I think that says that you're a loser.
Yeah, that's a great choice, actually.
Do you think it's telling that he wasn't even invited to Worf and Jadzia's wedding? Maybe he was out there in the fleet, you know, fighting the Dominion. Sure, you know, sure. Maybe that's
he was holding the door for people as they came in.
But yes, he was one of the ushers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I just think it's interesting that he wasn't even name dropped. You know, we did have Martok mention Cirilla every once in a while, not much, but he never once again mentioned Drex ever again. And I think it's telling that I must be a loser. Hey, he didn't seem all that intriguing when he was first introduced in Way of Warrior.
Do you think he was a character that, you know, once the writers created them, they're kind of like, eh, let's not bring him back. Like, we don't need this character.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's kind of like, okay, he fulfilled it. Well, because the other thing is, I don't think they ever envisioned that Martok would become such a prominent character in this series.
Should they have killed Drex? Bring him back in an episode and have him die in battle.
Or even don't even bring him back. Just like, hey, Martok, bad news. Your son's been killed in battle. That would give Martok, you know, some nuance there to play with.
Right, so he's kind of trying to fill that hole by making Worf kind of his son later down the road.
Yeah.
I think that would have been interesting.
But, yeah, missed opportunity.
That is, boy, another sign of a loser. Okay, well, I've got one. This is kind of another DS9 character. Only showed up in two episodes.
That's a sign of a loser.
This is George Primmon. He's in Season 1, Deep Space Nine. He was brought on as, like, the Starfleet security guy who's working kind of under Odo.
Oh, okay.
Now, this one's maybe a little controversial, because I think there's debates to be made that maybe he's okay. But he's played by James Lashley, and he shows up in the episodes Move Along Home and The Passenger.
That's why I remember who he was, is because he was in Move Along Home.
Right. Two episodes that are on no one's best list, except for yours, maybe.
Yeah. Guilty pleasure, Move Along Home for me.
But this character is brought in to essentially be angry that Odo has a better job than him.
Yeah.
So right there, we're like, we don't like this guy.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing about him that is likable. Well, he has kind of a, you know, I've never, again, like the actor who played Kelby, I've never seen James Lashley in anything else that jumps to mind, at least.
He must be on stage.
Sure. Dinner theater. Yeah. But he has kind of like a smarmy look to him, too. Like, he's a character that you cast to look kind of like a douche.
Do you recall his delivery in Move Along Home when he was greeting Odo in Ops?
No,
it was actually quite memorable.
Was it?
It was something along the lines of, like, Hello, Constable Odo. It's like clearly the actor just wanted something to pop there.
Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of like, okay, well, he gives off that those smarm vibes. I think it's also very telling that, it comes a little bit later on and his job's essentially taken over by one Lieutenant Commander Eddington.
Yeah, exactly. He's the proto-Eddington, essentially.
Yeah, and I think Eddington is a far more effective character than this guy ever was.
Yeah, definitely more depth, but also you could just see they were trying for something with Eddington. Versus this character, I feel... Well, do you know why this character was created, actually? He was created to cover for Cole Meany being away for a few episodes shooting a movie.
Oh.
Okay. So...
Just two appearances, eh?
Yes.
Okay. I would have said, well, maybe just to create conflict,
with Odo,
which I think was very effective when they brought on Eddington.
Right.
And this is maybe just their first go of it. Yeah, I guess essentially if you're bringing on and creating a character just to fill in the gap when one of your regulars is gone, right, then probably not a great sign.
And unlike some of the other losers on the list, like, he does have moments that make him a little more valuable. Like, he does, essentially save the station at a certain point in the passenger. He discovers, sabotage that could cause a lot of damage. So, he's not, he's not like the police chief in Die Hard, who's just, saying the wrong thing throughout the entire, through his entire appearance. But, especially, Move Along Home, he's always going against Odo. Odo's the character who we sympathize with, who we like, so we're instantly against Primin, no matter what he says. And so even when he does stop sabotage in the passenger, we're still like, get this guy out of here, we like Odo.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Well, for me, here's another one of our favorites that we like to bring up on the show, Cam. One Captain Stiles.
Yep, on my list too.
I mean, how many captains do you get to see carrying around a baton, filing their nails, and actually just taking snoozes on the ship when everybody else is hard at work?
Yeah, this character feels to me like pulled out of a 1940s comedy or something.
Yeah, and just for those who don't recall, this, of course, was the captain of the USS Excelsior, the first captain, as we saw in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. Look, even that pencil-thin mustache? Yes, Cam, he looks like he's, from 1940s comedy.
You expect the Marx Brothers to, come and, make fun of him.
Yeah. Is he the Zippo?
No.
Zippo's making fun of him.
Yeah. Zippo was basically, he was kind of the straight man. So he would just be watching while the other three make fun of him. But, Harpo would be, pouring water on his shoe or something like that,
I would love a scene somebody pouring water on Captain Stiles' shoe.
And he's played as a buffoon through and through.
Pompous buffoon, yes. Which is one of the best kinds.
Yes, and the whole his whole character arc is that ultimately he has his ship's transwarp drive sabotaged by Kirk, so Kirk can get away with the Enterprise. And he's left like, Kirk!
Okay, so we know that this guy likes to accessorize. If you look at his nail file, his baton.
Yeah.
Would you think, what other accessories would work for him? I think a monocle would.
There's got to be a hat.
A hat. Okay, what kind of hat?
I mean, the top hat is the obvious choice.
But what about those, safari hats that British soldiers would wear in Africa, during the Boer War?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And a monocle.
Yeah, and what are those things that they would wear around their necks in, the 60s, that men would wear? Austin Powers wore one.
Oh, with the symbols for, gender?
It starts with, a K or something. Oh, okay. It's a fashion item. Oh, my God, it's gonna drive me nuts. Some of the James Bond villains wore them, too.
Okay.
But either way, just, that sort of, stuffed upper shirt, type of look.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like cravat or something, I can't even remember.
Oh, okay, kind of like a scarf, sort of.
Yeah.
Cravat, yeah. Okay, yeah, I know, absolutely, I think that would work for him. And I think, a little handkerchief,
And he sneezes a lot.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. This is why when we pitched, characters we'd like to see return in Star Trek Discovery, give me a much younger Lieutenant Stiles. I would so love to see just the development of the character. Where did he get his baton? That could be the basis of an entire episode.
I would love if he was best friends with Finnegan.
Yes.
Interesting side note for some Cam fiction here. Forged in fire, Styles was killed by a Klingon pirate bomb.
I'm heartbroken. This breaks my heart more than David Marcus's actual death.
I kind of love that a spin-off novel brought Styles back to kill him with a pirate bomb.
I'm glad enough people were impacted by Styles, not only you and I, that he got his own, Cam fiction shout out here.
Right.
Okay. So, Cam, that does it for me. Okay, you've got a few left, so why don't you run through them, and we can kind of discuss a little quickly.
Sure, I've got two from the original series I'll touch on.
Okay.
And I've got one to end who's sort of a question mark. I don't know if he suits this topic at all, but I think he'd be interesting to talk about because he's a character we don't talk about.
Okay.
Or we haven't so far, I should say.
Interesting.
So one of the characters I want to talk about first off in the original series is Commodore Stalker, who's in the episode The Deadly Years. This is the episode where the crew starts rapidly aging due to a virus. And Commodore Stalker has to take over control of the Enterprise, and he's played by Charles Drake. He's kind of like the character you mentioned last week who took over during Cat's Paw. He's the guy in the command, the red shirt. But he's like, I'm in command, don't worry, I'll take this ship out of trouble. Stalker is the most incompetent captain replacement ever.
I love those.
Yeah, he's like, you know what, I got an idea. Let's fly into the Romulan neutral zone. Next thing you know, they're at battle with like multiple Klingon birds of prey. And Stalker is, like, paralyzed with fear and doesn't know what to do. And it's just like, oh, my God, I'm out of ideas.
Cam, you've come down on me in this before. Were they Klingon birds of prey or Romulan?
They were Klingon.
But Klingons didn't have birds of prey back then. They would have been battle cruisers.
Okay, battle cruisers.
Sorry, Cam.
You've got me.
Hey, look, I can geek out if this is a Star Trek podcast.
Fact check.
Okay.
We're getting real. Yeah. Yes, he's ultimately just like standing there paralyzed while chaos is raining around him, and thankfully Kirk is cured in time and is able to save the Enterprise from this simp.
what would it be like if we had, a spin-off series, or if he came back for Star Trek Discovery? Would we get the origins of his really feckless leadership?
One could only hope.
Yeah.
He's a character that is definitely not remembered at all. Maybe it's because The Deadly Years isn't a really great episode. It's one that's remembered more for the makeup than for being a particularly great episode.
The bad makeup?
Well,
you think it's aged well, though?
It's aged as well as most old age makeup in movies.
Which isn't very well.
Yeah,
I don't think anybody has done. Who do you think has done the best old age makeup, period?
Makeup? Oh my God, I don't know.
Because nowadays we're getting like CG sort of jobs when it comes to aging actors.
Yeah,
and de-aging.
Like, I think of like the CG aging of Hayley Atwell in the second Captain America movie. Like, that was pretty fantastic.
Yeah.
But in terms of makeup, there's an example and I can't even think of. Well, you know what? I will say one of the best ones is actually Charles Foster Kane in Citizen Kane. Orson Welles was, like, in his 20s.
It's quite simple.
Yeah.
They weren't, like, taking clay and, like, mashing it on his face. They're drawing in a few wrinkles and, putting a little powder on.
Yeah. Black and white worked a lot better for old age makeup. Once you get to, like, the color era and, jumping forward, especially into the 80s, that's where it really gets bad, where you have, like, the Back to the Future old age makeup.
Yeah.
And then even up to just a few years ago, J. Edgar.
Right.
With DiCaprio and Armie Hammer wearing, like, silly putty on their faces.
See, I would have thought that Al Pacino in Godfather 3 would have been okay until you realize that Al Pacino's aged about, like, 7 years in the last, like, 25 years.
Yeah.
So he doesn't look nearly as old now as he did in Godfather 3, which I think he's now older than what Michael Corleone was in Godfather 3.
Yeah, no, it's true. They always go really, really extreme.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, maybe that was the case in the older days when people aged quickly, but it doesn't make as much sense nowadays to do.
I definitely think that, yeah, more subtlety is. Look, we've go to these conventions, Cam. A lot of those actors have aged quite well.
Oh, yeah.
Intervening.
Far better than me. Oh, yes. Just over the last year, I've fallen apart.
Oh, it's the stress of the podcast. I don't blame you.
I know, the fame. Internet fame.
But I hope, you can alleviate some of that by making yourself feel better by talking about a whole bunch of losers.
It's all I have.
Yeah, I know.
So, the other one I want to mention from the original series is the character of Lazarus from the episode Alternative Factor.
Yeah.
This is the poor dope who's forced to struggle with his, like, negative version of himself for eternity. Oh, man, this whole episode is just awful. It's so bad. But ultimately, it winds up, he's trying to escape from this negative version of himself. They keep getting trapped in a negative magnetic corridor, whatever that is. And struggling in these really boring wrestling matches that take about 17 minutes each.
You know, that's when a script was thin back in TOS, is when they have very extensive fight sequences.
Yeah.
That last at least 4 minutes.
And they're in slow motion, and they're done in, like, negative aperture.
Right.
So they're just, they're mind-numbing to watch. Uh-huh. And it happens over and over again. And this character ultimately gets trapped forever struggling with himself in this magnetic corridor. And it just has Kirk at the end being like, what of Lazarus? And you can just, like, feel the collective shrug from everyone involved, like, we don't care.
Yeah.
Like, you know, destined to wrestle himself, fine. Just two dopes, you know. Just pathetic. Terrible episode. Real sad sack character.
Would this be perhaps your least favorite episode of TOS? Because you've mentioned this one before.
So, yeah. Yeah. I think it's my least favorite.
Is it mostly just because it's just really boring?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really dull. So, yeah. So, let's move into a character. I don't know if he applies. He was one I wrote down, and I think he's worth discussing.
Okay.
And that is Barkley.
Okay, you know, I did drop his name earlier on.
Yeah.
And I only did so because I did not think he was going to come up on either one of our lists.
I was very, I really questioned this because the show portrays him as one a lot.
Yeah.
But, and you have, like, episodes like Hollow Pursuits where he's addicted to the holodeck, and it's kind of portrayed as pathetic.
Do you think the reason why you and I are hesitating to put him on this list is because he's such a fan favorite that,
yeah,
you know, Dwight Schultz just knocks that out of the ballpark. He creates, like, this fully fleshed out character out of which is something that could have been a one-note joke, essentially.
Yes, and the other characters are quite warm towards him.
Yeah.
So it's really confusing because the show, on one hand, wants to portray him constantly kind of screwing up or looking awkward, while characters are kind of rooting for him.
So if our episode that we're doing for the podcast is called Star Trek's Biggest Losers,
yeah,
would it be fair to say that Barkley's a bit of a loser, but he wouldn't qualify as one of the biggest losers?
No, he's not one of the biggest. It's more the question of, does he fall into the loser category?
Yeah.
And I think it's a discussion worth having because, you know, I mentioned Hollow Pursuits. Another one that, you know, when he shows up in Voyager, there are scenes that are so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I think of the episode Pathfinder, which opens with him, you know, getting together with Troy and hanging out, and, like, he's serving her ice cream in his quarters. It is a scene that feels like if it were a movie, there would be, like, a serial murder shortly after. Like, it's,
sure,
it's so uncomfortable that I actually honestly had trouble watching it. It was just so stilted and had a real, like, unsettling vibe.
One of the reasons why Barkley's return on Voyager bothered me is because it seemed as if the character had regressed.
Yeah, that's the big thing. He's played, I mean, he was always obviously socially awkward, which is not the sign of a loser character in any way, shape, or form. But it's the fact that, like, when you see him in TNG, you are sympathetic to him. You,
yeah,
really feel bad for him, and you want him to succeed. Whereas in, especially, like, Pathfinder and in one of the scenes in Inside Man, too, the one on the beach, you feel sorry for the people stuck next to him.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is where the Barkley character is kind of twisted to something that I don't know if I would have considered him for this list were it not for those episodes.
I know. I don't want to put Barkley on the Biggest Loser list because I say that he has enough redeemable qualities where can you really be that big of a loser if, unlike Alexander Rozhenko, who doesn't appear to possess any sort of skills at all, he's an incredibly smart guy. You know, like, he's one of the most specialized, you know, crew members aboard the ship that they needed him. I remember specifically he had to work with Chief O'Brien in one of his first episodes, and he was a valued crew member. Look, yeah, he was a weirdo. He needed to get out of the holodeck a little bit more frequently, but the crew found value in him.
Yeah, and I think that's the key to the character and why he doesn't fall on the list, is ultimately he's redeemed by those around him. Unlike, you know, Kelby or so many of these other characters. Barkley is a character who's valued by his teammates, and is recognized as being good at what he does. And we see throughout the series, he succeeds in his job over and over again. Especially, you know, those scenes in those Voyager episodes are awful. Those conversation scenes with Troy. But ultimately, he's the one who builds the Pathfinder satellite system or whatever to communicate with Voyager. He's shown to be an important character to the Voyager crew. Like, they are looking to him to guide him, to guide them home. It's more like the show has a really odd way of portraying him. It's a way that I don't think any other character in the history of Star Trek has ever been portrayed.
No.
It's very strange.
But look, hats off to Dwight Schultz, though.
Yeah, he's great.
I kind of think it's disappointing that maybe they didn't find more opportunities to bring him back more frequently on Next Generation.
Mm-hmm.
I totally think that audience demand was there, and frankly, I mean, there's enough to give that character for him to feature even more. So I'm not going to put him in my loser category.
I'm not either. I just thought he was an interesting character to talk about under this topic.
Yes.
Yeah. He's one I feel like when you say Star Trek's Biggest Losers, a lot of fans immediately picture him, you know, in that holodeck episode or just, you know, there's all those goofy memes of him and, you know, that sort of thing. Like, he's an instantly, because he's a comedic character, he can fall under the goofball, which kind of might have him backslide into this category.
Yeah.
So I think ultimately we've got a fairly sad list here and an interesting spinoff crew for another Star Trek spinoff.
Incredibly sad. Yeah.
Who do you think is sort of the prime one of the group? Who's the one that you hold up as sort of the Lord of the Idiots?
Who's the biggest loser?
Yeah.
Honestly, and it seems like easy pickings, but I think maybe David Marcus is going to be the one. Look, if you ask fans who's the biggest loser in Star Trek, perhaps David Marcus.
Yeah.
But my personal favorite pick out of this, it all comes down to you and I watching that episode of Bound together a few weeks ago. Like, us laughing at Kelby nonstop. Yeah. Like, he was the inspiration for this episode we're doing today.
Yeah. I would make the argument that Commodore Stalker is the one who's just the flat-out dumbest. Like, the one who literally almost destroys the Enterprise. But to me, I think, I don't know if I would say David Marcus is the one I would say is kind of the Lord of the Idiots. I feel like just by pure reputation alone, Captain Harriman is the one that most fans would point to.
I think you started out of the gates very strong with that pick.
And I think a lot of people know Captain Harriman in a way they do not know a lot of these other people.
That's true.
So, okay, I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
We are going to be jumping on another two-parter episode. We'll be doing a review of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, The Maquis, Parts 1 and 2, which of course introduces us to The Maquis.
I have almost no memory of this two-parter.
Oh, same here. All I remember is a bag containing a Starfleet uniform getting vaporized.
I'm sold. This sounds great.
Okay.
You can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Vedic Bryle isn't on the list of losers? How did that happen? Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N. N as in no way Vedic Bryle would ever make my list of biggest losers, Cam.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.